Okay, this is a paper, this is based on a paper with John Deacom, Nicole Bell, Dan Hooper, and Tom. And based on some work John and I did some time ago. So the idea is, well, there are several ideas. So. Question is, do neutrinos decay? And of course, since the masses are non-zero, they're different, and there's flavor mixing, so they're going to decay. The only question then is, what are the decay modes and what are the lifetimes? And if the lifetimes are short enough to be interesting. And so what can we say at the moment about this? So I'll come back to that. So in standard model, at one loop you can have photonic decay of neutrino. And this is the decay rate. So the first paper I saw by Sergey, he's not around. 1977. So that's the result. So it depends on the lepton masses in the loop and the mixing alpha and GF square. So you put in the numbers, most optimistic numbers, electron volt masses, maximal mixing, and use tau. You get 10 to the 45 seconds for this lifetime. So that's too long to be of any interest. No, this must happen,
yeah.
But it's too long to be of any practical interest. So of course, beyond standard model, you can have arbitrary transition magnetic moments, and but even that you can bound from experiment. And the way you bound these goes like this. So here is the decay matrix element for the photonic decay. And if I define this combination, then these are bounded experimentally. The reason is that experimental bounds on neutrino magnetic moments come from neutrino electron scattering. Since you do not observe the final state neutrino, those bounds apply to transition as well as diagonal matrix elements. So that means that transition magnetic moments are bounded by the same values as the diagonal. So you put in the experimental bounds and you get these limits on the lifetimes. So this does not assume standard model. This is arbitrary. So this is just experimental limits for electron volt masses. So that's also too long to be of interest.
Not the last one.
Yeah, not tau. Tau is
nice. Okay, just, yeah.
Really
yeah, okay, just, yeah.
I mean, there's an awful lot of neutrinos in the universe.
This is only about 1 year.
But this is
20.
With a
photon. Photon in the final state.
Okay.
Yeah. So electron volt photon in the final state. Yeah. There is one caveat that has been raised recently, namely that these bounds are evaluated for the Q square momentum transfer of MeV, whereas the decay modes take place at electron volts. So is that a problem? And these people looked at this and they claimed that unless the form factors are bizarre, this extrapolation is okay.
By the way, Ferrer is coming here, I think, next week.
No, he's coming. Okay.
Right. And you're leaving?
He's standing there, but he's
okay.
Over there.
Yeah, I am going over there via the coffee pot.
Oh,
there
we go.
Okay, there are also direct experimental bounds which are somewhat weaker from supernova, from X-ray and gamma ray fluxes, reactors, and so on, which are weaker than what we had before.
The supernova bound is just from the fact that the expected number of neutrinos actually...
No. There's no bound from that. I'll come back to that. This is a bound from not seeing photons. No spike in the photon. Right. Exactly.
I don't understand. You do see photons.
No, this frequency.
No, it should be photons. MeV photons.
MeV? I thought we were talking about EV.
No, but these are in the lab. The supernova neutrinos are traveling, at 30 MeV. If they decay, you should see 15 MeV gamma ray, and we don't. From there, this bound comes. Okay, so to have fast decays of the kind that we can put bounds from other places, they have to be invisible. Again, in the standard model, you can have this invisible decay, three neutrinos at one loop. So again, if I just calculate the phase space for this and then have an epsilon for the off-diagonal element of Z coupling to neutrinos, you get this. Even if epsilon is as big as 1, you get 2 times 10 to the 34. So no suppression. And of course, currently what we know about epsilon is something like 100, less than 100. And so that gives me 10 to the 38 seconds.
What is epsilon?
Well, this matrix element is epsilon times GF. It's the 4 Fermi matrix element.
Oh.
And epsilon in standard model will be some small number at one loop. So even if it's 1, it's uninteresting. So then it has to be some new particle. So you can have a variety of possible couplings. For example, left goes to left plus some massless particle. And this by SU2, as we learned yesterday from Irina's talk, will give rise to the same coupling for the charged leptons. And so you would say, OK, charged lepton limits on such decays will constrain neutrino decays. And this charged lepton bound is surprisingly weak. So for example, mu goes to electron plus a massless scalar or vector is only 2 times the minus 6 branching ratio, which is tau is about the same. So they're very weak. Although they're weak, they're good enough to constrain the neutrino lifetimes to be uninteresting. So again, the neutrino lifetimes are quite uninteresting. So the only thing that remains is for fast invisible decays are the so-called Majorana type couplings. Triplet and singlet, where the lepton number of this guy is 2. And this does not give rise to any charged lepton decays, so it's safe. If you have a pure triplet, then it's constrained by Z invisible decay width. And so either you have a singlet or a mixture of singlet and triplet with fine tuning to control the Z. You can make such models. They exist for a long time. And so as I said, they are not constrained by decays of charged leptons. This is what I just said. And the couplings to mu type and electron type neutrinos are constrained by pi and k decay and universality in pi and k decays. So there's some bounds on those. Okay. Now, the decays are of mass eigenstates, not of flavor eigenstates. But since mixings are large, everything I said about nu e, nu mu, nu tau, as if they are decaying, still applies because the mixing angles are large. So, well, I don't have to say anything about that. So, what do we know about such lifetimes into such invisible modes at the moment? So here is L over E, here is tau. This is tau in the rest frame converted from the lab frames. And so the limits from lab or atmospheric are rather weak, because the path lengths are small. So you get something like 10 to the minus 10 seconds. For example, the models that were invented to explain the atmospheric neutrino anomaly needed lifetimes of 10 to the minus 10 seconds. So that's not very long lifetime, so very weak limits. The path length to the sun for electron volt neutrino corresponds to 10 to the minus 4 seconds. So you can, that's the kind of limits you can get. So eventually from galactic supernova or this high energy decay that I'm going to talk about, you can get better bounds. So maybe from astrophysical neutrinos, you can get better bounds or evidence of decays. So to go beyond to this, I'll make two working assumptions. That there are sources of neutrinos and fluxes are such that we can detect them here. And that we have detectors that can do that. Both of these have to be satisfied for me to go any further. Okay, so. Not on invisible decays for electron volt neutrinos. For a photonic decays, yes, there are. But so they're not interesting. So, okay. So what do I want to show? Yeah. The most models of neutrino production in astrophysical sources, like AGNs or GRBs, the dominant processes supposed to take place are either gamma p to pi n or pp to pi x. And so in both cases, you get pions and subsequent muons from pi decays. Now, if the muons are allowed to decay, then this will give you the flux of neutrinos, flavor mix of 1 to 2 to very small. Of course, and this is more or less what we have in the atmospheric in the energy region up to 10 GeV. Now, beyond 10 GeV, the electron neutrinos disappear because muons don't have enough path length to decay before they lose energy. And so you get 0, 1, 0 eventually at high energies in the atmospheric neutrinos. If something like that happens in these sources and the muons lose energy either in matter or in by magnetic fields, then you will get this kind of flux. Or if you have some other process, not this, but some heavy particles decaying like Z, then of course you get 1 to 1 to 1, it's universal. As I said, this is small. But generally, when the energies are very high, you will get some production of new taus because you'll make charmed particles and B particles, and which have significant branching ratios into tau, and you'll get some new taus, some epsilon. You can study what epsilon might be, and it's small. Okay, somebody, we can discuss that, but I don't think it's interesting. It's small. Okay, so you start with either 1, 2, 0 or 0, 1, 0, depending on what's going on at the source. And then the neutrinos propagate and oscillations will take place. And as everybody knows, if the L over E is large enough, and this argument is large, then the sine square will average to a half. And the survival and conversion probabilities will be simply these. And assuming there are no significant matter effects en route, people have looked into this. And if the densities and the path lengths in matter are large enough that matter effects are significant, then most likely the neutrinos will be absorbed anyway. So there'll be absorption taking place, which you have to worry about. So at the first approximation, we assume there is no matter effect. Then, from the current knowledge of the mixing matrix, you can construct the propagation matrix. And if you use the solar angle of 30 degrees, you get something like this. And if this acts on the initial flux of 1 to 0, you get 1, 1, 1. Actually, this is very general. And 7 years ago, when John and I first looked at this, we looked at many possible mixing angles, and we found this is what happened. In fact, this depends only on two things. One is that the UE3 is approximately zero, and nu mu nu tau mixing is approximately maximal. Then you get E nu tau 1, 1, 1 if you start with 1 to 0. So for example, if this is the mixing matrix, then the propagation matrix is this, where A is the sine square of 2 theta, and this acting on this gives you 1. So the deviation from this goes like UE3 square, so which is like 3 to 4%. Oh, if some mass differences, I mean, now that we know that E mu tau mass differences, or 1, 2, 3 mass differences are what they are, the atmospheric and the solar. But if that wasn't the case, you can ask the question that with the path length to a AGN or GRB and energies of PEV, what kind of delta M squares you can probe in this well-known Lernet plot, which was first plotted by John. And it's focusing. Where is the focus? There's no focus.
It may be on the lens if you rotate the cap and the red effect. I can see
this.
Yes.
Maybe. Oh, yeah. Oh, there is a net here, a spider net. Beautiful spider net right here. Okay. So John plotted this some time ago, and then many of us have used this. So here is the energy, and this is GTK cutoff, and I assume now we can go beyond this. And this is the Hubble length, so this includes all possible L over E. And here are for a what kind of delta M square you can probe at what L and what E. So here is LSND, short baseline, reactor, atmospheric, long baseline, solar. So this is a line of constant delta M square sensitivity. So here is the kind of delta M squares you can probe, something like 10 to the minus 16 or so electron volt square. You can make it larger when you go to you saw. Oh, this is constant delta M square sensitivity. Okay. In other words, pick a length. Okay, so here is some length. Then, at that length and this energy, this is the delta M square you can reach. So that's. That's when delta M square L over E is close to 1. That's what. So it's just a constant slope, basically, yeah? So anyway, in principle, you can reach such small delta M square if there are such small delta M squares. So for the moment, let me assume that the initial flux is 1 to 2 to 0 and ask the following question.
It's like in the atmospheric neutrino.
Well, atmospheric neutrino 1 to 2 to 0 is valid within a small range, 1 to 10 GeV.
The sub-GeV.
Yeah, up to 10 GeV. Beyond that, it's all new mu's. So same thing can happen here also. So that's another possibility one has to look at. Pardon?
Until you get up.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay. So the question we asked is, when is this not 1, 1, 1? So there are many possible, several possibilities. One is, as I said, initial flux is not 1 to 0, then you don't get it. Or neutrino decay. But suppose some mass eigenstate, mu sub I, is unstable. Then in the propagation matrix, when I have u alpha I squared, it will be multiplied by the exponential decay factor, the L over E mass divided by the rest frame lifetime. If this is short enough, then this term goes to 0 everywhere. So the simplest case is only one mass eigenstate survives, all the others decay. Now, depending on whether the hierarchy is normal or inverted, the lightest is either nu sub 1 or nu sub 3. And that's the only guy that will arrive at Earth. So what happens then? It's trivial. So on the arrival, if nu 1 survives, then the flavor mix is simply given by this 3 matrix element square. So in what we know, it's just the solar angle cosine sine square over 2, which is roughly 6 to 1 to 1 for 30 degrees angle. On the other end, if nu 3 survives, the inverted hierarchy, then the nu UE 3 is almost 0, so you get 0, 1, 1. So obviously these are quite different from each other and from 1, 1, 1. So this is the signature that decays have taken place along the path to the Earth from long distance. So this is the basic result.
Would you get the population pattern like this if what you call the environment, the initial conditions were different in a reasonable way?
No, I'll show you what actually it was on the transparency. I didn't mention it. Let me just flash back to that. What happens if the muons lose energy and don't decay? Then, yeah. So if you multiply the same propagation matrix by 0, 1, 0 at the initial flux,
yeah,
then you get 1/2 to 1 to 1, which is quite different from what I just removed. So they're all different, each one of them. Yeah. So there's 6, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, and 1/2, 1, 1, quite distant. You can also ask what happens if UE3 is not zero. So this is what happens if UE3 is not zero. So here's UE3 square from 0 to 0.03. And so let's take normal hierarchy, where I have 6 to 1 to 1. So if I change UE3 to be non-zero, then nu e goes from 6 to 3.5, nu mu remains 1, and nu tau goes to 0.3. So they're still different from 1, 1, 1. They're still quite distinct. I'm not sure. I think that's what the interference term is, UE3. So it's not just UE3, but UE3 square, but the nu mu and nu tau mixings change. Now it can't be 1 over root 2 anymore.
True, but I mean, okay, it is changed by UE3 squared.
No, because it'll be, okay, it's 1 over root 3, let's say, plus UE3 or minus UE3. You square that, there is a linear term in you. There's the linear term.
In the matrix, you have the cosine of theta 1 3, which in the U tau 3 and the U mu 3. Is that what is important here?
Okay. I think what will happen is, look at the third column,
right.
UE3.
This is what I'm doing.
Yeah, so 1 over root 3 minus something.
1 over square root of 2.
This will be changed now from the original.
Yes, but it will be changed by square root of 1 minus UE3 squared. And this is small.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember the algebra, but okay, we can check.
This is another example where small angles can make huge differences contrary to
big vision. No, I'm sure you're right. They just don't.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I agree.
You it's not talk obvious. To Irina afterwards. She's worked out analytic coincident and independently. She has analytic formulae for these.
Okay.
But it is surprising.
It's surprising.
Two differences, yeah. In your case too.
Okay, that's the simplest case. In general, of course, we don't know what the scenario is. Maybe only one of the three mass eigenstates decays. Also, there is the when you write the decay model of a Majorana type, what happens is the neutrino, the parent neutrino, can decay into nu and nu bar. And the branching ratio depends on the mass hierarchy. So if they're nearly degenerate, you get 1. The branching ratio is 1 to 1. In the other case, it's 1/3 and 2/3. So you have to worry about that. So you have to know what the branching ratios are. Of course, if you're not going to detect them separately, it doesn't matter. Then also, if it's Majorana, then they're both flavor neutrinos. If they're Dirac, then one of them is inactive. So that that will change the signal. Also, depending on the mass hierarchy, the energy of the final neutrino is different. In one case, it's the same as the initial. In the other case, it's degraded. So you take that into account. It's sort of a detail. So anyway, you can do that. And so we did that. In the simple case, when the energy is not changed, then this is what happens. depending on which decays and what's the branching ratio. And then, so you'll assume something about the spectrum. And then, when they are nearly, well, the hierarchy case, the energy is degraded. So you have to include an integral over the degradation factor, which is this. Then you have to assume what something about the spectrum. You do that, some power spectrum of the initial flux. And then here is the number of possible scenarios. So this is for normal hierarchy. So the simplest case, as I said, was initial state. The 3 and 2 both unstable, so the only one survives. Then we get this. Let's say only 3 decays, and 2 doesn't decay. And the daughter is sterile, then you get this. And then the full energy, 3 decaying into 2, and degraded energy, you get different things, 1.6, 2.8, depends on various assumptions. So you get the 611 is not always 6, but it can be 3, 2, 1.5 or something, depending on the details. So even, so what did I want to say? Yeah. Okay, we tried to think of other physics scenarios which would change the flavor ratios from 1 to 1 to 1 to other things, and like magnetic moments and so on. And none of these did anything for us. So, okay. I'll come back to that. Detection of these flavors and how do you distinguish the flavors. So in a kilometer cube type detector, there is a muon tracks, which give you muons, showers with no other tracks. Now the showers will contain neutral current events of all flavors and electron charge current events as well. And then the new taus are distinguished by either double bang or single bang. If the energy is high enough, like a PeV, then what a new tau will do in the detector is the decay length. So the new tau comes in, interacts, makes a tau, and a tau at a PeV has a path length over 100 meters, between 100 meters and a kilometer, between 1 and 10 PeV. So you get a very energetic shower, and then a track of over 100 meters and a second shower when the tau decays. And this is the classic double bang. And we can also have sometimes you may not see the first bang, but you just see the track and a shower at the end. And that is also indicative of tau, because nothing else can make, muon cannot make such an event, except one case. And so that's been named lollipop by people in Madison. So you can have a double bang or a lollipop, which is a new tau. So also
sounds better than a fly swatter. A fly swatter. That's a line of the movie.
Okay. Also, the characteristics of this double bang are that the two energies of the two showers are related roughly by the second one is twice the first one. And the length should be more than 10 meters to make sure it's a tau. And we looked at other backgrounds to such events and found they're small. The most serious one, I'm sorry, this downloading transparency is not readable. Anyway, suppose the new mu comes in and makes a mu, and there'll be a shower when the first charge current interaction takes place. And the mu travels and without radiating, and at the end of its track has a catastrophic bremsstrahlung in which it deposits all its energy. That will look like a double bang, but it's not a tau. And there is no good calculation of this, so we made a crude estimate and we got something like 0.3%. So it could be a few events which will be muons, but will fake either lollipops or double banks. So you will have the new tau bar from either double bang or lollipops, muon tracks. So that gives you taus, this gives you muons. And then the cascades, and once you know the number of taus and mus coming in, neutrinos, you can then estimate neutral currents and subtract them and you get mu equals mu bar. You can also try to see if you can see some Glashow resonance events in which mu e bar makes a W on shell at 6.4 PeV. So anyway, in principle, from these you can determine the fluxes, individual flavor mix. Okay, if you are lucky, very lucky, and you can see number of events with different energies and different distances to the sources and know the distances, then if these decays are taking place, you can actually try to measure the lifetime, not just get a limit. Or, you know, lifetime is shorter than something or longer than something, but actually get it. And because then you can reconstruct something like this. Here is energy, here is the distance, increasing this way, energy increasing this way. So here is inverted hierarchy, normal hierarchy. If everything is decayed, you should see E to mu to tau 611 roughly, right? But if some of them are closer, then they haven't decayed completely. So you can, here is 111, and you can see the evolution from 111 to 611. Similarly, here's for inverted hierarchies, you can see the electron going to zero starting from 111. So
you actually need this. You need the distance information to separate all the possible.
I mean, otherwise, if you have only one source and a few events, and if you see 611, you say, okay, they have decayed, but you don't know the lifetime exactly. But if you have these, you can.
But if you have something in between, then you don't know if it's one of the all of the other possibilities you listed before or a distance effect.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. But I mean, then you should see this pattern as a function of distance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is basically the John and other collaborators from SuperGA used to show us this asymmetry plot, sort of function of L over E of the atmospheric neutrinos, in which the point at which it happens tells you delta m square, and the height of the step tells you the angle. This is sort of like that. Similar plot. It's L over E. You know, the L over E plot for the AGNs.
So for DEV energies, what kind of distances does that correspond to? Do you know?
100 megaparsec.
Oh, okay.
Something like that. So here's a summary. So if you do the flavor mix and you can identify it for some events in KM3 or ice cube, and you measure E over mu over tau, and you, let's say you find alpha go 1 to 1, let me assume there is no difference between this, a very small difference. If alpha is 1, you confirm standard model. This is the most boring case. The oscillations are exactly as we know, nothing is happening, and the initial flux was 1 to 0. That's one possibility. Or there is some funny source which is 1 1 1, which we didn't know about. If alpha is about 1/2, then the source is like very high energy atmospheric neutrinos, with only new mu's, and they're conventional standard oscillations, nothing else is going on. If alpha is bigger than 1, you have decay has taken place along the way with normal hierarchy. If alpha is very small, near 0, then decay is taking place with inverted hierarchy along the way. And then, of course, you don't know any details, how many have decayed, all two out of 3, or 1 out of 3, or what. That depends on the details. That's very hard. So anyway, that's the bottom line. Okay.
Can I have a comment on
this
last point? I mean, when the initial flux is 1, 2, 0,
yeah,
you get alpha 1 just because you use maximal mixing for the atmospheric angle.
Yeah.
If you take a little bit deviation from it,
yeah, then this will,
then, the
then 1, 1, maybe 1.9 or something, 0.8.
Alpha will be not 1, but it will be a little bit greater than 1.
Yeah, and this will be a little bit smaller than 1.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That will be U if you...
It's not the atmospheric neutrinos case.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. There will be some corrections, yeah. Sub-leading corrections to this, yeah. Exactly.
You should draw this up in the way our old neutrino triangle things.
Yeah, how it changes, yeah.
Because if you make this triangle whose axis is, say, the horizontal axis is the muon fraction, vertical axis the electron neutrino fraction, then the only way to get into the top piece of that triangle is through some decay mechanism like this.
So yeah.
It's kind of nice to map it out that way.
Collaborator from Mailing Center, Fermilab, we actually did that, the Mandelstam plot. Three things on
yeah.
one,
yeah.
Mandelstam.
Yeah.
So we did that, and it got voted down by the Fermilab.
It's already in our paper, John and mine paper in 95. We did that exactly. Yeah, it's been done, yeah.
Foley and Lisi like to do it for there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, Sergey, you missed the most important transparency. So
oh, the cycle down is nice.
Yes.
Oh, that's very kind of
you. Okay. So presumably this Myron is thermalized and then we're bumping up against the area and beating up people.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. So yeah, yeah. More. If the decay is fast enough, yeah.
So Ray Sawyer voted Todd Thompson, if there were a funny source, it was only electrons and protons. So then basically the ratio nu e to mu to tau was charge current to neutral current to neutral current. So ironically, you get a 6:1:1. That would be nasty.
So that's an example of something that also gives different from 1:1:1.
But it would be strange to have a pure electron plasma spinning up neutrinos at these energies, I think, I hope.
Yeah. Then you would get a hell of a lot of photons from such sources, wouldn't you?
I think so.
Yeah. Many more photons.
We know their protons are 10 to the 20, so something is bumping around.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Blissfully short.